Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson sitting across from me is
Mike Cosentino.
And we have our funny-looking green and pink and yellow earphones on, which means we have someone, we have a caller. And our caller who's coming, is calling us today, our guest on the show, is Thomas Paley. He has his undergraduate degree from Oxford. He's originally from Zimbabwe. And his PhD from Yale. He's worked for a congressional commission on U.S.-China relations that monitors the relation. He's worked for the AFL-CIO, a very popular organization here in Arizona. And are you there, sir?
Yeah, good morning, Steve.
And
good
he's
morning,
written Tom. A really, really interesting book, called, Financial Crisis to Stagnation, the Destruction of Shared Prosperity and the Role of Economics. And Dr. Paley has a different point of view than you probably heard other places. And out here in Arizona, we basically hear one conservative account of what happened. And one of the things that Thomas Paley done is describe different perspectives. And the dominant perspective out here is what he calls perspective number one. Could you tell us about it?
Yeah, well, thanks, Steve. Yeah, what I have tried to do is make available different interpretations of what is going on in our economy and how to understand the crisis. I mean, I actually believe that's the best way to help people understand, rather than just give your own point of view, give people the different interpretations. They can then match them up with the facts and see which, once people have some different arguments in their hands, they're capable of making a good understanding of what's going on. And what I've tried to do is outline what I think are three different stories that are out there that you will hear in the press, you'll hear in the election campaign, and people have got to make up their minds which fits the facts best. Now, story number one is a sort of the hardcore free market story. And that story is that the crisis is due to government. And there are two ways in which government caused the crisis. One way is that supposedly in the last recession, that's the recession of 2001 to 2003, the Federal Reserve pushed interest rates too low and held them there for too long, and that caused a house price bubble. So bad monetary policy is one way that government caused the crisis. And the other piece of the story is that Congress interfered in the housing market through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and through the community redevelopment requirements, and it basically pushed too many people into home ownership, and Congress sort of got people buying homes they couldn't afford. And so that's the other piece of government.
How did they account for the collapse? I mean, I often hear people tell me that it's all because of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that the thing collapsed. But how did that cause the collapse in Ireland and Spain? And
well, that's another story. I think we should really talk about the U.S. economy. It's hard enough for people to understand that without going global. But let me point out to people that Fannie Mae was established in 1938. It's been around for a very, very long time. And to say suddenly that in 2001 it was the cause of the crisis is really doesn't make sense. And another very big point here is Fannie Mae is involved in residential mortgages. If it were just if Fannie Mae were just the cause of the bubble, then we would only have seen a bubble in residential mortgages. But we didn't. We saw a bubble in commercial real estate. In fact, some of the fall off was even bigger. That's what brought Lehman Brothers down. So when you dig into the facts, and that's a part of the book, trying to make the facts available in an easily understandable way, in a way that you can compare them, the story doesn't add up. And another thing that I report is what was going on Wall Street with mortgage lending. In fact, Fannie Mae was not leading the lending in subprime. It was being done by Wall Street. Wall Street was agitating to get Fannie Mae out of the way. Fannie Mae was losing market share. All the data point to the fact that it was Wall Street pumping money into the economy. The same with the community redevelopment story. This is a very small part of the of lending, and lending losses on community redevelopment has not been any worse than anywhere else in the economy. If this was the center of it, it's a classic case where you sort of pick on the weakest group. Right. And then you blame them for causing the crisis.
I think, yeah, before we go on to part two, why does this become the dominant story? Certainly dominant story in Arizona, government regulation, it caused this, so forth and so on. Why does that, what is the origin of the power of that story?
Yeah.
That's
well,
widely believed.
This goes back a very long way. And it kind of, in my view, it goes back to the real true center of the crisis. In 1980, roundabout there, use that as a symbolic date, we decided to reconfigure the American economy. We'd had 35 years of really, by historical standards, a golden age of shared prosperity. And it had begun to have some problems in the 1970s, but that was sort of due to, if you people remember, the OPEC oil price shocks, and there was some adjustment to be made. But the economy was still functioning pretty well. We reconfigured it. And a big part of the propaganda for reconfiguring it was government was the problem. And that has been a story that we've been telling over and over again for now for 30 years. And people still believe it. So the folks are trying to defend the system that has been put in place, the system that has done so much damage, the system that has caused wage stagnation, the system that has caused so much increase in wealth inequality, and the system that is ultimately responsible for the financial crisis, are going back to that story because they know that story has grabbed people's imaginations, and people seem to understand it, whether or not it fits the facts. I call it, you know, some of you folks in Arizona, I know you like to do country dancing and things like that.
Yes, sir.
I call it the right-wing conservative two-step. I'll tell you how in policy terms, how the two-step works.
Let me say, and hold on, because I want to point out that one of the things that you said and the functions of your book is that economics is rooted in social choices. It's not a product of nature. It just doesn't spring up and all of a sudden become a dominant force in our lives. That this is a result of choices, and as you say, the two-step. Go ahead, sir.
We'll just stay with that riff for a minute. You're absolutely right there. There's some things we can't control, okay, whether we've got oil in the ground, whether we have sunshine, whether we have arable land, that sort of thing. There are some forces of nature at work. But then what we do with that is very determined by social choices, about the arrangements we make, the institutions we make, the behaviors we adopt, and so on. And that's where economics and behavior come into play. And that's where we have a lot more choice, and that's what this debate is all about. What type of market capitalism is going to bring us shared prosperity?
And exactly.
Is it a mean street market capitalism so that the Wall Street folks are pushing, or is it a main street market capitalism? That's the debate that I would like to see us as a country have, and you folks in Arizona contribute to. But we never have that debate. It's always said one side says it's for capitalism and claims the other side is against capitalism. That's nonsense.
Yeah, socialism or capitalism.
Socialism
always
versus,
and socialism.
And that's just a misrepresentation. I wish people would see through it because that will then enable them to grab hold of this debate and stop politicians from giving them false choices. And let me go about the two-step, the conservative two-step. How it works is you put in place a set of policies that then do a tremendous amount of damage and cause a lot of problems. Then when you have the crisis, they then say, well, now the only way out of this crisis is to double down on those set of policies. So that's the second step. And then you can go on repeating it. And that's where we're stuck right now in our economic policy discourse. That's what I'm hearing from Mitt Romney and the Republicans. And I'm not hearing the Democrats challenge them and offer people an understanding of this. And that's what I'm trying to help people do in this book, is help understand and help them gain charge of the debate, and let's take it in a direction that's going to give us shared prosperity again.
In perspective, too, you call it the soft core position. Basically, those are the economists who believe that increased regulation, you know, You saw an attempt of Washington to increase regulation will prevent the problem. But you think there's a deeper problem that can't be solved, say, by regulating Wall Street.
Right. That's right. This second perspective is very important because in some ways it obscures us from seeing the real challenge. And if I have a criticism of the Obama administration, it is it's because it bought into this second perspective. What they said was that the financial crisis was due to lack of regulation on Wall Street, faulty regulation. We didn't oversee Wall Street enough, but everything else about the system was okay. And that's sort of the position that the president went for in 2009, 2010. That's why we had Dodd-Frank. Now, at one level, they're right. We didn't have enough regulation on Wall Street, and everyone knows that. Anyone who's seeing what's going on and seeing the pay that these people were paying themselves, the guys who brought Lehman Brothers down, they're all out of the door for the multi-millionaires.
I got a 5% raise, by the way, according to headlines.
Yeah, and it's still going on. And they were not paid for performance. They were paid on speculation. And if they made money on day one, they took a cut. And if they lost on day two, they were gone. So there was a problem. We do need to regulate Wall Street, but it's not enough. And the proof of the pudding is in the eating. What have we done? We have passed Dodd-Frank, which is a very good piece of legislation, very needed. We do need to make sure that the rulemaking that accompanies it is now done with teeth. But that is not enough, and that's why we're stuck in stagnation. There's a deeper structural problem that we need to put on the table and then put in place the reforms that are going to fix that structural
Hence the
problem.
Title of your book, the financial crisis to stagnation,
exactly
to
right.
shared prosperity. From stagnation to shared prosperity.
The opening chapter is goodbye crisis, hello stagnation.
Okay. We've talked about this before, and people have seen their wages stagnate for decades, and it was disguised. We were talking to a sociologist, Link Kenworthy. It was disguised by the fact that people had two incomes, so it didn't seem so bad. It was disguised by the housing bubble. If you had more money back to the internet bubble, all these things sort of disguised what was happening. So, productivity is going up like climbing a hill, and income, at least for ordinary people, is just pretty much flat.
But it's not just wages; it's pensions. The people on retirement thing, they're not getting the COLAs have disappeared years ago.
And people are more and more depending on Social Security for their retirement. There's no pensions. But what you're saying is this. Increase, and talk to us about this
yeah.
increase, this destruction of shared prosperity. Because after World War II, the money was shared out pretty evenly. I mean, the top always got more, but it was pretty even. And you're saying, if I understand you, that it's this destruction of shared prosperity that's causing these repeated crises, and particularly this particularly nasty one we're in now.
Right. Well, it's a little more complicated than that, unfortunately. But let's get a couple of pieces of information on the table. The first thing is this very, very important thing about the link between wages and productivity growth. If you look at the data, after World War II, we put in place a system. This is based on the New Deal and the Keynesian economics that came out of the 1930s, the Keynesian understandings that came out of the 1930s depression, that wages would grow with productivity, and they did. In fact, there was actually even a slight redistribution towards the bottom of the income scale, away from the top. But in the mid-1970s, we fought a political war that the right wing won, and they then put in place new arrangements that severed the link between wages and productivity. So you saw productivity continuing to grow. By the way, not as fast. There's this great story about how all the Reagan stuff was so fantastic for the American economy. But in fact, after 1980, productivity growth in the economy slows down. It's not as good as it was in the 30 years before. So productivity keeps rising, but then wages flatline. Now, people don't quite realize this immediately. Well, first of all, there's a bit of inflation going on, so they think they actually do see a rising number. For a while, they think that's an increase in pay, when in fact it's not, because it's being eaten away by rising prices. They do make some adjustments, as you say. There was more and more two-family workers. A lot of mothers went into the workforce, more and more labor force participation. That helped cover up the family shortfall. There's another thing going on. In the old days, it used to be the case you started with a low wage, and as you moved, got a little older, a bit more experience, you got your wage increased. So there was a bit of a rising, what we call a wage profile, and that helped camouflage to younger people. They still thought they were getting increases, but they weren't the increases that their parents got. And right, then at the very end, we had this... And
we see people getting 35-cent an hour wage increases here. That's 35 cents is considered, 50 cents is considered a wage increase.
Yeah, it may or not be depending on what's happening to prices, but it's really not the same as what's going on with productivity. So, and then the final step that started in the late 1990s and really accelerated in 2000s was this house price inflation that basically gave people access to an ATM. You had a home, you could get home equity on it, you had an existing home, you sold it, you maybe bought another one, you took some of the profits of your other home, you turned some of the equity into debt. That really kept the boom going, and there was a proliferation of credit cards, easy credit. All of that helped obscure the wage stagnation problem. But that whole system blew apart in 2008. You can only go on lending for so long. Then eventually you have to pay off the bills. And the whole thing imploded. We realized that we had been giving out a lot of bad credit, bad loans. We'd been covering up. What was going on in this economy was we were eating away at the middle class. There were sort of something you might know, there were termites in our economic foundations. And that had been covered up by debt that had helped generate the spending that covered this wage weakness.
And that's why people didn't really realize, ordinary folks that's didn't right. really realize what was happening until the crash.
Right.
Well, we had
shell prosperity. It was a shell in the sense that it was hollow based on credit. And when the credit flows stopped, as they have now, when the home prices increases couldn't keep on going on forever because homes were becoming so detached from people's incomes, then people said, "Wow!" When the Ponzi scheme finally blows up and you realize there's no there, then it all implodes and collapses, and that's when the problem. This problem of wage stagnation and this problem of income inequality became visible.
Talk about the union piece.
Before then. Now it's out in the front, and that's what we need to start talking about, because only by fixing that do we get out of the hole we're in.
Yes, sir, and excellent idea. But also, I want to work in the union piece here, work in the workers' piece
yeah.
here. There's,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, this is really key, and I know it's a very hard thing to get in because there is such hostility towards unions in this country. Big business has got that they regard unions as the enemy because they challenge.
I was president of my local for a couple of years.
How to get people to think in solidarity terms is a really big challenge. But what I can talk to you historically about is what the key change that came out of the Great Depression of the 1930s was the rise of the American labor movement. And that is the key institution that connected wages to productivity growth.
There you go.
That's the key institution that made sure that working people got a share of the prosperity. And when that institution was intact, we had shared prosperity. What the 1980s onwards have been all about is breaking the American labor movement, taking the power away from working people, so that cutting them out of the action, and we've done that through tax on unions, we've done that by retreating from full employment, we've done that by making sure the minimum wage falls away so that it's not a real wage floor anymore, and we've done that through economic globalization. This has been the corporate agenda in Washington, and we really need to call that, and the trouble is that corporations, again, through this, they have a tremendous amount of money to control the type of economics that is taught, to control the type of political viewing that you watch, to control Fox TV. It turns people against unions, and then that, in a sense, divides people from themselves, because an individual is not going to have the power the FIDA Corporation, that is a massive collection of capital.
Well, that's it. We always marvel at how people will vote against their self-interest, and all the entities you just mentioned are the ways that they're led down that road.
When I was younger, I was in a union in New York. And there was a non-union, these are hotels, giant luxury hotels, and there was a non-union hotel, and the non-union hotel paid workers a little bit more than the union was able to negotiate. But people don't realize that their non-union wages were dependent on having the union raise the wages of everybody else. People don't make the connection. So talk to us some more about
the chamber.
This.
The chambermaid can't compete against Marriott. You know, that's a mismatch.
Right. That's
a total mismatch. Can't think of any. You can't think of a more unfair fight than that.
Yeah, we didn't really strike, but union organizing thing, we fell one vote short. And the company had promised people all kinds of stuff, and when we fell one short vote short. Within 6 months, everybody who was a union supporter,
right,
we were
right,
all gone.
Right.
All for legitimate reasons.
Well, the nurse can't compete against United Healthcare.
Absolutely. The flight attendant can't compete against United Airlines.
But
you run down the list.
I'm just saying,
collections of capital that people don't stand a chance against that power.
The strongest union right now that I cast my vision around, it's the nurses, the National Nurses Network, the 160,000 active members, and of course they're all campaigning for the Buffett rule and a couple of other things. But
well, it's really good to ask why people lost sight of this very core insight, because I mean I find that at one level it's very intuitive and people do get it, but what's going on in our culture, we have another story. That is, people can go it alone and make it alone. This is the frontier. And, of course, you guys in Arizona are, you know, closer to the frontier than we in Washington certainly are. But even then, we're in this together. And society and economies have always worked when we work together.
I think that's
somehow
what people don't see.
Somehow this romantic narrative that they can go it alone and they don't need help from anyone else. And that until we get over that and see how we can cooperate and work together, to get a fairer distribution of things, then we're going to be stuck in this stagnation.
So what you're saying is that a fairer distribution of the results will lead to more prosperity, where people believe that if we distribute income and wealth more fairly, that'll lead to less growth. And you're saying it would actually lead to more growth if people had better incomes, better retirement?
That's absolutely the truth. Right now, anyone talk to anyone about our current problem, and it's a shortage of demand. Ask any businessman why they're not producing more, why they're not hiring more workers. It's a shortage of demand. And the surest way to fix the demand problem is a better distribution of income and wealth. Now, this is the trouble with economics. It's, you know, Harry Truman always used to say, give me a one-handed economist, because every economist you talk to says on the one hand this and on the other hand that. And I'm going to do exactly that right now.
Okay.
I can tell you that if you had an economy where the profit share was 0%, it wouldn't work, because business would not undertake investment. And I can also tell you that if you have an economy where the profit share is 100%, that's not going to work either, because you're going to have no customers. So we know we've got to get a balance between wages and profits, between the distribution of income, somewhere in between. And I would say we had it about right from the period 1945 to 1980.
I see.
And then what we've done over there, we've shifted all the economic power to corporations, and we've just cut and cut and cut at the labor share. And that's the trouble we're in now. We've got to put in place the institutions that reverse it. But remember, I'm still a two-handed economist, too. You can go too far on both sides. And I just want people to understand now how we've gone too far on the side of empowering business and capital and increasing profits and increasing wages, salaries at the very top, and cutting working folk out of the pie. And that's why we're in this stagnation.
So the stagnation is being generated by, in your view, by income inequality, by the lack of sharing out the money that creates a low aggregate demand.
Yeah, I don't want to hold Henry Ford up as a model here, but he did want workers that could afford his product. And I don't think that's happening so much.
Yeah. Well, Henry Ford's a complicated man. If you read his biography, he's not a very nice man.
No.
But on the other hand, and he did talk about, he introduced the $5 a day wage, which at the time was great. His actually real reasoning, though he used the rhetoric of buying my car, the real reasoning was he said that he thought the workers would work harder for it. Mm-hmm. The idea that you need customers came later in the Great Depression when we realized, you know, if you look at the numbers again, 1929 looks a lot like 2008.
Yeah,
the numbers look pretty much the same.
We've had economists on the show suggest that a simple move, and I'm kind of big on big simple moves, and even though they may be in there. Anyway, raising the minimum wage to $12, $13 an hour would create a mass of people with living wages
and an
economic buying power that will do exactly what we've been talking about, and that's create demand.
Yeah, I'm definitely a supporter of raising the minimum wage in a series of steps. But here's the problem. One of the problems we have: we have integrated our economy into the global economy. This was the corporate agenda. Make sure that we are integrated in the global economy.
Right.
Therefore, we face competition from foreign producers who have access to foreign labor and so on. So, if you raise wages, you've got to make sure you also fix the way in which we're integrated into the global economy. Otherwise, we're going to make ourselves uncompetitive.
To be fair, that started with
economics
Clinton.
Gets complicated. Yeah. And this is something I really want to emphasize to people, is how when you lose control of the policy debate, the other side puts in place policies that are very hard to undo. What globalization has done is changed the structure of the economy, so it's taken away some of the freedom of choices we had about economic policy, and it makes it difficult to do the sort of measures that you've just been talking about. Now, we can do it, but it just goes to show how important it is to take charge of economic policy, but otherwise bad things happen.
Sure, we've seen that. It started, to be fair, it started under Clinton and then went crazy under Bush. I mean, just really the globalization thing. And then, as you say, it's almost really difficult now to try to pull back. I don't believe that the crafters in the 90s thought it would ever get this far. I don't think they intended it to get this far.
Well, I don't know. The corporate guys that I see in Washington, they're a pretty extreme group. In terms of their goal is profit.
Wow.
Businessmen talk about profit, and profit is different from the well-being of the nation.
That's not shared prosperity.
Yeah, that's not shared prosperity, and that's something that's going to be very important in this upcoming election. People say we want a businessman to run this country. I don't think so.
Bain's going to come back.
Working people are going to suffer if that happens.
If we have 2 minutes left, how would you sum up your book? And let's give folks the available on Amazon. It's published by Cambridge University Press, and it's called From Financial Crisis to Stagnation. That's a big improvement. The Destruction of Shared Prosperity and the Role of Economics.
Well, we sure like the ring of shared prosperity around here, Arizona or no Arizona. It's, if that's the route out, then bring it on.
Right. Well, what I would say to people is that this crisis is not the result of some shock or surprise or what they call a black swan on Wall Street. It's about choices we've made over the past 30 years that have undermined the foundations of shared prosperity. In the book, I try to show how that worked. I try to show how the arguments that conservatives are saying that we need more deregulation, more laissez-faire, more cutting back on protections against working people will backfire. And then I try and show people some simple solutions that, look, if we do these things, we vote for the candidates who are recommending this. If not even that, right now we're not even getting the candidates providing the right recommendations. We've got to demand that our candidates do better.
Thomas
Paley.
The
Democratic Party, too.
Thomas Paley, economist and author. This broadcast will be on our website, vvid.org, in a day or two. You can listen to it again. Like a lot of these shows, the content is a little bit thick, but please listen to it again. I think it's been pretty clear, and we've done a good job. Thomas, thank you.
Steve, thanks very much.
Yes, thanks very much for coming on. Next week, we have my brother coming on. My brother was in the practical side of business, manage the finances and the investments of the largest independent bank in the U.S. You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.